Most of you know that this summer we've been doing this series entitled The God Who Satisfies, and we are well into that, halfway or more through. I'm still trying to determine exactly how much longer to develop this and what to do next, but we are well into it. And what struck me as I was getting ready for this week is that I actually have not defined the word satisfaction. I have talked about it a lot, being satisfied in God, or God's our satisfaction, but I haven't actually taken the time to define that central word. So, I looked it up in the dictionary this week, actually several dictionaries, and chose the statement in the mother of all dictionaries, the Oxford English Dictionary. And this is what it says about satisfaction, quote, "The action of gratifying an appetite or desire to the full, or of contenting a person by the complete fulfillment of a desire or supply of a want. The fact of having been gratified to the full, or having one's desire fulfilled." Now let's ponder that for just a moment here. Definition of satisfaction. You start out with some desire. You start out with some need. You start out with some appetite. To be satisfied is for that desire, that need, to be completely met, so that you're not going around wanting anymore. Whatever it is you started wanting, because you've gotten it all. Sufficient. All that you need for that desire to be pacified. That's what we mean by satisfaction. The emphasis in that definition is on the expression to the full, or other words that were used there, complete and fulfillment. Have that same idea. The idea of sufficiency, the idea that you have had enough, that at least for the time being, as far as whatever desire you were considering, you are not looking for more of that from some other source. Wherever you found it, it gave you sufficient to be content. Now, we know this from earthly experiences. I recognize, for example, that often we do not get a good night's sleep, but probably, hopefully, we have all had mornings when we have woken up and we feel rested, like, I got enough sleep. I feel pretty good. And I don't really want to stay in this bed any longer. I want to go out and use some of this energy that I have recovered. Doesn't happen very often. But there is such a thing as a good night's sleep where you got enough and you're ready to go. You were satisfied as far as that issue is concerned. Or when you sit down and eat a hearty meal and you eat to your heart's or your stomach's content, and at some point it is enough, and to have any more would actually do you damage and make you uncomfortable. We know what it is to have a full stomach. We have been satisfied. It has been completely filled up. Or the sense that we get, a sense of peace and pleasure and wholeness from sitting down at some spot out in God's creation and watching the sun rise or watching the sun set, and there is a kind of a closure as we observe that event. And we find our hearts put to rest, like this really somehow ministers to me a sense of completeness. That's a kind of satisfaction. Or the same when you have just finished listening to a piece of music that you really enjoy, and there have been ups and downs, and there have been all kinds of developments, but there is a kind of a resolution at the end, and you get to the end of it, you feel like, okay, this is now complete. I am satisfied as far as this piece of music is concerned. We speak also of the satisfaction of a job well done. So we had some task we were given, we had some job we were to do, and we worked hard at it, and we accomplished our objective, and it's over, it's done for that day or that period or whatever. And there's a kind of a sense of completeness as you look back on what's been accomplished. You have as well a feeling of gratification after you've had an extended time of conversation with somebody that you love, a family member, a close friend. And after you have exhausted whatever it was that you were talking about, and you have enjoyed that interaction, and it has deepened your closeness to that person, and they have ministered to you, and you have ministered to them, there's a sense of wholeness. Like, we have caught up now, and this has been special, and now we can go on with whatever else is before us. We understand satisfaction in all of those different ways. Now, what about satisfaction in God? Here is what I came up with as at least a provisional definition. A sufficient sense of ultimate wellness that God ministers to the believer through his character and works. Let me say that again. A sufficient sense, in other words, this is something you actually come to feel, to experience. It's not just like an idea or a theory or a doctrine, but there's something in your heart that experiences a kind of a wellness or a sense of wholeness, and it comes as God himself, through his Spirit, takes some truth of his word about his character, about his works, and he ministers it to you personally. And especially we want to focus on that word sufficient, because what that emphasizes is that as it relates to the kind of ministry, the kind of sense we're talking about, when God does this in your heart, at that point, you really aren't wanting to look for it from other sources. And you recognize the emptiness or the shallowness or the limitations of seeking this experience from somebody or something other than God. It is sufficient. I thought of Psalm 23:1. It just states it so beautifully. We know this verse. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Or you could translate that, I lack nothing, as in, the Lord is my shepherd and I have everything I need. And he has met completely what I expect out of God and what I need at the heart level. I don't have any other desires, or I'm not looking for my desires to be fulfilled somehow apart from or outside of him. And I also want to highlight the word wellness, a sufficient sense of ultimate wellness. That is very broad. We could think of the Hebrew word shalom as one way to describe it. But I think we need to keep it broad, because there really is a great variety of these kinds of experiences of satisfaction, depending on our need and desire at the moment, depending on the circumstances of our lives, depending on what it is about God that we might be reflecting on or that he is bringing to our attention. And it would include experiences like peace and consolation and delight and joy. And you could probably continue the list. A sufficient sense of ultimate wellness that God ministers to the believer through his character and works. Now, how can God do that fully, right? Satisfaction has to do with fullness. How can God do that completely and do it for every believer, which is a whole lot of people, to keep satisfied? God is able to do that because there are no limits to his greatness and there are no limits to his goodness. He has a never-ending well from which to satisfy us. And there is a word, there is a theological word for that. We speak of the Lord as infinite. He knows no limits. And from this inexhaustible supply, he then is able to satisfy the heart fully of every believer who approaches him for this. And so that's what we want to consider this morning, the satisfying infinitude of God. And there is a classic passage on this theme in the Old Testament. It is Psalm 139. I invite you to turn there this morning for the message, for the text today, Psalm 139. And what this passage lays out for us is a sequence of thoughts, a sequence of realities about God that have the effect of ministering to us this sense of satisfaction, and in a variety of ways. This passage is divided up into four stanzas. We're going to take, first of all, verses 1 to 6, as we consider the satisfying infinitude of God. We learn from these verses that the infinite knowledge of God inspires wonder. The infinite knowledge of God, that is what this is taken up with especially. We call that his omniscience. And the effect, the satisfying effect on us, I'm capturing with the word wonder. And we'll hopefully see how that fits together. The infinite knowledge of God inspires wonder. Verse 1 says, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. And though this passage could detail the omniscience of God as it relates to any subject out there in the world, the great truth that is so special, that is so meaningful to David at this point, is that he has searched me and known me. The word translated search there is interesting. It is used sometimes in the Old Testament of a spy. Now, we understand that this has to be a figure of speech because a spy is somebody who covers himself in some way, who pretends to be something he is not, and the purpose is to discover information that he doesn't know already, right? In the case of God, the Lord is not learning something new, like he has to go on a search or kind of hiddenly get behind the scenes and figure something out. This is a figure of speech because we know that God knows all things instantaneously. He doesn't have to learn anything, and he knows it continually. It's not like he knows a lot of things now and then more later. This is all at once and all the time. What is the point of saying that God has searched us and known us? It is highlighting the thoroughness of his knowledge. We might say that no stone has been unturned, that there is no aspect of our life, of our behavior, of our character, of our circumstances that God is not aware of. There are no hidden issues. Nothing escapes his notice. And the emphasis isn't on that he learns this somehow through a process, but that he knows it thoroughly, like, for example, a spy comes to know. And then he goes on to give some examples. And verse 2 says, you know, for example, when I sit down and when I rise up. This is another literary feature, literary device. It's called merismus. You learned a new word. I used the word infinitude and now the word merismus. We're actually going to see a number of illustrations of this in this psalm. What is that? It's where the author will give you two items that are on either extreme of a list of things. And by giving you the extremes that bracket the whole list, he is saying everything from one extreme to the other, not just those two things, but everything in between that forms that whole spectrum. And so when you think about the activities of your life and of any particular day, there's a point at which you sit down and it's over for the time being, and there is a point at which you rise up and you start over again. And the idea is God knows not just those two things, but every activity that occurs in between. And he knows it. Think about that verb for a moment. This is not referring simply to a mental awareness of trivia, like I got up at X hour of the day, or these were the muscles I used to get up or to lie down. This is not talking merely about trivia and little bits of information. It's a verb in Hebrew that very often refers to a knowledge that has a personal concern attached to it. Now, we recognize that God knows all these details about wicked people as well. He knows they're lying down and they're rising up. But this is a passage written by a believer about how these truths regarding the Lord minister to him. And he is convinced when he speaks of the knowledge of God that this is not just the Lord having this information, but that that is all a part of him being concerned about these details and working in my life favorably in connection with all of this information that he knows. And this is a blessed truth to the psalmist here. God doesn't just know the facts and everything factually there is to know, but he actually cares about us, and he is favorably disposed to us. On the basis of the information, he ministers to us and he pursues our good. And the verse goes on to say, "You discern my thoughts from afar." With the word thoughts there, speaking particularly about our intentions, that is, what drives the actions of lying down and sitting up and everything in between. He knows not only what we do, but why we do it. Our loves, that would be one kind of intention. Our loves, our hates, our battles of conscience, our temptations, our emotional struggles, our fears, and anything else that might drive us to carry out an action. He knows every one of our intentions, and he knows it from afar. Again, it's not like he has to investigate this or get down close. He is well aware of this without any effort on his part. Verse 3 says, "You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways." And the word search out there is actually different from the other word search. It doesn't have to do with spying. It actually could be translated winnow, kind of like these ancient peoples. When the harvest came, they would go out where it was windy, maybe on the top of a hill, and they would throw up the grain, and the wind would come and blow away the chaff, and the heavier, substantial, nutritious stuff would then fall, and that way they could collect it and use it to make their bread and so forth. God winnows our path and our lying down. That is, he makes distinctions. He distinguishes between what is worthwhile and what is worthless, and what is important and what is not so important. Actually, in that first line, you have another one of these extremes, right? My path, you're walking, and my lying down. And if we wondered whether we should assume that that includes everything in between, the second part of the line actually says it explicitly in this universal language: you are acquainted with all my ways. Every last part of it, internal, external. And to give one more example, the author in verse 4 starts to mention about his words, his talking. "Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all together." That is one category of things God knows thoroughly. And again, there is the internal external, because God not only knows the words that come out, but he knows them when they are still forming up as ideas in our minds, and what it is we want to get out of those words, and before it actually comes out, he is already aware of what is taking place in our hearts. Now, when you read just those four verses that we've covered so far, how does that make you feel as you think about the exhaustive knowledge of God? Well, we get a sense of that when in verse 5, the author says, "You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hands upon me." And there are some, I was actually surprised how many commentators take that statement in a negative sense, with the idea being that the psalmist feels pressured by all of this. Like God is besieging me. He is restricting me. He's just controlling me such that I can't move. I can hardly breathe. And so the psalmist is kind of tempted to try to run away from God, which is what they get out of verse 7. Where shall I go from your spirit? Like, I can't take God knowing me so thoroughly, so I'm going to at least try to get away from him. That is how some make the connection. But it seems to me that that is misguided, for one, because all the way through the psalm, you sense a positive, favorable posture from the psalmist back to God. These are great truths. These are precious truths to him. They're overwhelming, to be sure, but they are positive. These are blessings. These are meaningful to him. These bring him a kind of satisfaction. He's not afraid of it. And in fact, that positive response to God's omniscience is indicated by the next verse when he says, verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. You know, that word wonderful in English has lost a lot of its force. It doesn't mean really what it actually should mean. It's kind of like our use of the word awesome. When we say I had an awesome vacation or a wonderful trip, we just mean by that it was really good. I enjoyed it a lot. It was great, and I wish I could do it again. Something along those lines. That's not really the meaning of the words awesome or wonderful. Not in English and not in Hebrew either. Wonderful means it's full of wonder. It creates amazement. You are blown away by it. You stand in awe of these things. In fact, this particular word wonderful in the Old Testament is associated with that which is supernatural, even miracles, things that blow you away because they are clearly, exclusively divine actions. No human being could do this. And you stand stunned and speechless. And you are aware that there is this supreme force being exercised by the God of the universe. You are in wonder here in this context specifically, standing in wonder, amazed because of the infinite knowledge of God that is so far above anything we could ever understand or conceive of. There's a very fine line. It's a quick move from the idea of wonder to the idea of worship. That's really what's happening here. He's not just confessing this as a doctrine. He's not just saying he's blown away. He is telling God just how great he is. He is confessing these truths. This is an act of worship. And that is where we get to the idea of satisfaction at this point. I said that the infinite knowledge of God inspires wonder. What does that have to do with satisfaction? Well, I think we realize that by God's own design, the human heart is wired for glory and for greatness. We are all instinctively looking for something, some transcendent reality, some amazing experience, some overwhelming person that causes us to rise above the ordinariness of our daily lives. Something that fills us with astonishment and draws out admiration. That's what we are looking for, and even if we're not conscious that we're looking for, that's what we get a little bit of a taste of when we climb some mountain and look out on this vista. When we sail the vastness of the oceans, it is why we gawk at the Grand Canyon or why we travel to outer space. We want to be wowed. There is something fundamental in human nature that is longing for greatness that way. And how much wow could there be to satisfy that itching of the human heart than the kind of God that has just been described in these verses as knowing every last detail about you personally, and not just your actions, but the intentions of your heart. The infinite knowledge of God inspires wonder. And that is especially the case to you if you really have been convinced that this God is for you and not against you, which is what we start to get into as we go to the next part of this, verses 7 to 12. And we see this truth that the infinite presence of God produces security. The infinite presence of God produces security. He brings up these questions in verse 7. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? I really don't think he actually wants to try to run away. He is posing that question hypothetically in order to make his point. He is taking what he has already confessed to be true about God, and he's kind of testing it geographically to see if all of that about God's omniscience holds true everywhere in the world and without exception, to just bring up the possibility that maybe, just maybe, there is some place where Yahweh does not have access to. And of course, we see, even by the question itself, that he is going in the direction of saying there really is nowhere. There is nowhere that I can go to escape this total awareness of God regarding my life. But he gives us some possibilities to consider. And he says in verse 8, if I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there too. And there is another one of these extremes. Go as high above, as far up above you as you can imagine, up to the sky, as far as the eye can see, or as far low as human beings can conceive as well, in some secluded cave, or even underneath the surface of the earth where bodies are buried. That is the sense of Sheol. As far high as I can imagine, as far low as I can imagine, God is present. Verse 9, another set of extreme. If I take the wings of the morning or the dawn, and I dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea. So he has already in verse 8 spoken of up and down extremes, and this is sideways or east to west extremes. So I get up where the sun rises, and the word morning there refers to the dawn. And I go as far as I can see out there to where I have noted that the sun goes down at the end of the day to the uttermost part or the extremes of the earth. And even there, verse 10, your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. Now here we definitely see clearly the positive spin or the positive tone of the passage. He isn't saying only that God is there in all those places everywhere. He says, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand is going to hold me. And these are good things. The idea is, if I end up going to some of these places, I'm not going to get lost ultimately, or somehow be apart from God's presence to direct me and help me know what to do and where to go and what choice to make. That word lead there occurs in a well-known story in Genesis 24:48, as Abraham's servant is going to a faraway place to do something rather ridiculous from a human standpoint. Whatever your dating or engagement story may be, if you are married here, it wasn't as obviously supernatural and as unusual as this. This guy gets up and travels far away to Mesopotamia, hundreds of miles, shows up, nobody knows him, and he approaches this woman that has never laid eyes on him and says, I want you to go marry my master's son. I mean, who does that? a proposal by a total stranger, and it's not even that he's proposing that he marry her, him. He's proposing that she marry this other guy who's not even there. She's never seen him. And yet God providentially works all that out in the circumstances and in the hearts of those people. And it says, then I bowed. This is his response. Then I bowed my head and worshiped Yahweh and blessed Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, who had led me by the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. God led me. He opened the way. He directed the path. He worked in the circumstances and all the people involved in this situation. He guided me. That's a precious truth, but so is what it says in the second line, your right hand shall hold me, which is a word that means to hold tight, to grab onto and not let go. We would say to grasp, as in God's not going to abandon me or let go of me. And as I thought about that line, here is a little summary. You can take this away with you. And maybe it'd be easy to remember because both of these words start with the letter G. Wherever we go, the Lord guides us and the Lord grasps us. God guides me and God grasps me wherever I may happen to be. And that's why I'm saying that from a practical standpoint, the application is the infinite presence of God produces security. He guides me and he grasps me. And he develops that a little bit more. Two more verses here, verses 11 to 12. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. There's all kinds of interesting word pictures in this passage. I'm just touching on a few, but for example, that word cover, surely the darkness shall cover me, is the same root that we know well from Genesis 3:15, where it talks about the seed of the serpent crushing the heel or bruising or crushing the heel of the seed of the woman, or the other way around, that he is going to crush or bruise the serpent's head. It's a word that refers to brushing or crushing or bruising, not just kind of generally hovering over and covering. And the idea seems to be that David, when he thinks about the darkness, he is overwhelmed. He is fearful. He naturally tends to fear threats that he might face when, because of the darkness, he's not able to see clearly around him. The darkness is crushing or bruising him in the sense that when it's dark, you are more likely to be attacked by your enemy. You cannot see well. You have a harder time warding off the attacks. And he says to the Lord, it doesn't matter. The amount of physical light is not a factor to him. He illuminates every place and he is in every place. And this ministers to me a sense of profound security. I thought of a New Testament parallel to all of this, the wonderful words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 10, which are also highlighting how God's infinite concern, presence, ministers to us security. Jesus says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, but even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not. Therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. The infinite presence of God produces security. Now, notice that the word starting the next section at verse 13 is the word for. For you form my inward parts. And what that indicates is there is a close connection with what we just saw. David has just been talking about dark places where God is present and active to work on behalf of his people. And now he is giving a specific illustration of a dark place, confirming the Lord's presence there. What is the dark place? How much darker can it get than inside your mother's womb? That's what he is detailing now. And yet, he is not simply talking about God being present in the dark place, but this new thought is added that God is very actively and very intricately working, using his creative power to accomplish his purposes for the psalmist as an individual creation. And that is one aspect of what we refer to as the sovereignty of God, which is another dimension of his infinite glory. And the fact that there is no sphere over which he is not sovereign. And that brings us to the third thought here. The infinite sovereignty of God generates comfort. Again, these are not to this man scary thoughts. These are warm, assuring, comforting truths. 4, verse 13, you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. What is it that God is doing in that dark place? He is, for one, forming the inward parts. That word literally is the kidneys, which in the Old Testament, it is used largely as a metaphor for the deep-seated emotions or the internal makeup of an individual. And so one translation says, you form my inmost being, focusing there not so much on the physical, but on the immaterial part of it, your personality, your likes, your dislikes, your inclinations, all that goes into what drives you inside your inner person, apart from sin, of course. And then he says, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. And that word knitting is fascinating as well. It can be used to refer to a craftsman who is weaving together a tapestry and bringing all these apparently disparate threads together, multiple colors, multiple textures perhaps, all woven together to produce something that is coherent and something that is unified and something that is beautiful. The Lord has given that kind of attention to the details of your inner person. And when he goes on in verse 14, even though he's really not done teaching on this topic, it's like he can't say anything else for the moment without uttering another word of praise. And this idea of wonder is woven through here, even though it was kind of the main point of the first stanza. He just can't hold back his amazement and his response of worship. I praise you, 14, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Here it is again. Wonderful, awe-inspiring are your works. My soul knows it very well. And having sung that little song, he's going to continue with his theme in verse 15. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. And here again, the Lord is pictured like an artisan with these terms. In fact, the root translated intricately woven is used of the weaving together of the curtains of the tabernacle in Exodus 26:36. Again, all these different colors of threads embroidered together. Verse 16, your eye saw my unformed substance, and in your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. I love this verse because it moves again from one extreme to the other. He has been talking about the whole conception and development and birth process, and he still has it in mind, your eyes saw my unformed substance. But now he's thinking also of the rest of his life from that beginning. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me. That one statement moves all the way from conception to death. Yes, God forms every part of that little baby, material, immaterial. But he also forms every day that baby is alive. He determines the exact number of days we are to live on this earth. And he superintends all the circumstances of all those days individually, one by one. And I was so glad that I had been meditating on this passage when I was visiting with Wayne Gowan's family Friday at the hospital, and I was able to read this statement from the Lord to give them perspective that if this should be the day when this brother dies, it was no accident, it was unexpected to them, but God had, from all eternity, every single day planned out, and this is just the outworking of his sovereign plan. And with that truth in mind, listen to the response now in verse 17. How precious, that is, how rare, how unusually valuable to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. Most of that is this instinctive response of worshipful wonder once again. I want to highlight what it says at the end of verse 18, I awake and I am still with you. Whether in the darkness of sleep, when you might feel very vulnerable, or in the full light of day, David is always with the Lord because the Lord is always present everywhere to accomplish his purposes. It's kind of funny that some people in reading this at this point in the psalm actually say that he has been trying to dwell on these things and figure them out, and he wore himself out meditating and fell asleep. And that's what he has in mind when he says, I've fallen asleep thinking about these things, and something jolted me back up, and nothing's changed. I'm still with you. You're still here. We see here this emphasis on the comfort that the believer draws from the all-encompassing and the benevolent sovereignty of God over the affairs and every last detail of his life. And is this not what the New Testament is developing when we find this assurance and it's all tied to the work of Christ? And we're told, for I am sure that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. There is no place and there is no experience where you are separated from God in any sense. And this is telling us that there's no place where we are not separated, where we can be separated from God's love. Now, these are great truths, but you're getting to the end of it and you're kind of surprised. It's rather abrupt when he goes from talking about these precious and comforting truths to all of a sudden saying, oh, that you would slay the wicked. And you're thinking, what in the world does that have to do with this? He's been directly dwelling on God and he's been encouraged by all this, and now he's praying out of nowhere that God would slay the wicked. What is the point? Well, here's one way to think of this. Given everything that has been said about this God, this is not a God that you can be ambivalent toward. When God has revealed himself to be this way, you have to take sides. And you are either on his side or you are not. And that gets to the final point here. We could use the word loyalty to speak of it. And I would put it in these terms. Number four, this is our last thought, that the infinite character of God motivates loyalty. And part of this psalmist declaring that he is loyal to this God is to say that he is not loyal to the enemies of God. In fact, he is outright, dogmatically rejecting those people as the kind of people whose lead he is going to follow and whose side he is going to take. I mean, this is very strong language. Oh, that you would slay the wicked. Oh, men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. I mean, how do you account for that kind of prayer and that kind of attitude? One thing we need to note is that the word hate in Hebrew is not quite the same in many cases as we would think of it in English. It doesn't necessarily communicate that you just really don't like these people, that, you know, they kind of hit you the wrong way and you just have this sort of bad attitude or ill will toward them, or just for whatever reason, because you don't like them or because they hurt you personally, you have this animosity toward them. It's more the idea of, I have chosen to reject them as my associates and as the kind of people that I am following. It is a firm choice not to align with them and with their lifestyle. And that kind of decided rejection, it really is the only appropriate response when those people are actually taking a rebellious stance against the God that you treasure. Right? How can you say, God is my security, and God is with me, and he comforts me, and he's ruling over my life, and I treasure him, and I value him, and he's so precious to me. How can you have that attitude and over here be treasuring and treating as special and fawning over and following the people who are rebelling against God? It's one or the other. You've got to take sides. That is the negative side of loyalty, and he ends with the positive side of humble submission to God's will when he says in prayer, verse 23, "Search me, O God, and know my heart." And he ends where he began, right? He talked about, "Lord, you have searched me," and now he prays, "Lord, search me." Same word having to do with spying. He just opens himself up. He invites the Lord to investigate him thoroughly. He knows he can't avoid it anyway, because God already knows. But David wants the Lord to actually show him in his mind and heart and conscience what is going on within himself. There is that practical application, and that display of loyalty is this openness before the Lord. One commentator said this: the psalm is certainly a holy meditation on doctrine, but as a meditation, it is more than theological reflection. It is an application of doctrine to life. The psalm not only probes the nature of God, but also shows the significance of it all to the way we live. And how easy it is, right, to confess in a creed or taking a doctrine's test, God is omniscient, what's the passage for that? Psalm 139. God is omnipresent, what's the verse for that? Psalm 139. God is sovereign, and just confess these things in kind of a rote and mental way. The spirit of the psalm is, Lord, because all this is true about you, I'm going to find my satisfaction and my whole purpose in life by aligning myself unto you. This is the only way I can experience satisfaction, is if I humble myself before you. I ask you to show me my sin and to deal with it. You do that to begin with when you're converted, as God exposes your heart of sin and you cry out to him to deal with that through Jesus. But you do it again and again and again throughout life. He says, "Try me and know my thoughts," which is the same request, but another image of smelting and refining metals. Lord, remove these impurities, and particularly the word thoughts. You might have a translation that says, "Try my anxious or my disquieting thoughts." There's an act of disloyalty, given all that's been said here about God, that I would continue to be anxious and filled with turbulence and confusion in my heart. It's so inappropriate in light of who this God is. And he says, verse 24, "See if there be any grievous way in me, lead me in the way everlasting." He wants to be shown anything in his conduct that offends or that grieves the Lord. He is actively seeking and submitting to the leadership of this sovereign God. And he is sure that this is the path to everlasting satisfaction, something enduring, something permanent. This path of humility issues in eternal life. "See if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." It struck me that that would be a very appropriate thing to pray during these next few moments as we are gathered around this ordinance, as we are reflecting on how the sovereign God has acted in history through Christ to deal with our sin, to remove it objectively. It continues to cling to our hearts and our lives. Here is a wonderful way to express our loyalty to the Savior who gave his all to redeem us. And that is just to take up these words of self-examination. See if there be any grievous way in me. Lord, is there anything that is offensive to you, that you find to be displeasing? Please uncover it for me. You know what it is. Show it to me. I want to be turned. I want you to be able to look at me and be thoroughly pleased with what you see there. This is the right response to the kind of infinite and infinitely satisfying God that this passage has laid out for us.